We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover. Starting with local and the garbage strike. Waste management.
Yeah. Waste management settled with the Teamsters on Thursday with the garbage strike that all told lasted, three, 4 days. So garbage will be picked up again in Seattle. The untold piece of this story in terms of how it got settled was that Mayor Mike McGinn, for all the grief we've given him over SPD and other issues on this show, actually did something right in this case, in that he changed the calculus of waste management in terms of how much it would cost them to actually try to bust the union, which has been their historical pattern in other parts of the country. The reason is that both in Federal Way and Seattle, there were portions of the contract with waste management that allowed the cities to impose fines for every day of service missed. Those fines in the case of the city of Seattle could have amounted to $1.25 million a day. And in the case of both Federal Way and Seattle, the mayors informed waste management that they absolutely intended to collect those fines. So suddenly, particularly in the case of Seattle with McGinn, waste management realized that it was actually going to cost a lot more for them to continue the strike and continue to be intransigent than they otherwise had. And literally, according to one of the negotiators, waste management was back at the negotiating table within hours of McGinn's announcement. So he deserves some credit for that. And also remember, McGinn was originally elected in place of businessman Joe Malahan, and it's a fair bet that Malahan would not have taken that step. So, you know, for all of his faults and mistakes over the last couple, 3 years, in this case, we should be thankful that we elected McGinn rather than Malahan.
Mm-hmm. All
right. Developments this week regarding the third arena.
Yeah, this week the King County Council approved the arena deal by a 6-3 vote. Now, the three council members who voted against it were Reagan Dunn, Larry Phillips, and Pete Von Reichbauer. Von Reichbauer had the most to say. He was particularly concerned about the traffic issues around the port. Dunn also said that he wanted to see more numbers, which is the tack that the Seattle City Council took. They sent a letter this week to hedge fund manager Chris Hansen. They wanted to see some of the tax revenue from the arena be used to pay for road improvements in the SoDo region. They also want the city to be first in line to be paid in case of a bankruptcy in front of other creditors, like, say, private banks, for example. And they want Hansen and Company to disclose how much equity they're actually putting into the LLCs, those limited liability companies that they're going to set up to build the arena, to manage and run the arena, and to manage the teams. And the city also wants verification of some of the financial projections and the performance targets that Hansen has given them, which I think is probably the most important part of this, asking, you know, how much are you guys putting into it, and are these realistic projections? Because my feeling is that they're probably not.
Well, they're absolutely not, and the reason is, and we've talked about this in past month shows, is that for both the city and the county, the Chris Hansen projections have been based on the idea of getting both an NBA and an NHL team in. And in both the case of the city and the county, the public is on the hook for a great deal more money if only one of those comes to fruition, which will almost certainly be the case, because there is no precedent for teams from both leagues moving to the same new city at the same time.
Yeah, and that affects the economic viability of running and managing the stadium once it's built, if you've only got one team in there.
Absolutely. And the other piece of that is that if, in fact, you had only one team as a tenant and no immediate prospects for a second team coming in, there's a very strong likelihood that Hansen and his investors would come back and want to renegotiate those deals, which means all of the stuff that they're talking about now could get thrown out the window. And again, we could be put on the hook for a lot more money.
Yeah. In the meantime, the port also weighed in this week, too, on the arena deal. Port consultant Peter Steinbrück suggested that the port had earlier suggested that the city and state should do an environmental impact statement on the arena. And then McGinn and Dow Constantine came back and said, oh, yes, well, that's all part of the construction process that'll happen after the agreement is approved.
Wait a minute. Aren't environmental impact statements supposed to happen before the planning that happens before the construction?
Yeah. I'm just trying to track that. Yes, that's the port's point. And then Steinberg came in and he suggested, well, how about a carbon impact statement, since the bulk of the attendees at the new arena are projected, according to Hansen's projections, are going to be coming from outside the city, from the surrounding county and other parts of the state. Why don't we do a carbon impact statement, since, you know, Mayor McGinn is supposed to be concerned about driving and trying to reduce traffic in the city of Seattle. Here we're going to build something that's going to encourage, you know, people to drive more. Maybe we ought to be doing carbon impact statements for a lot of big projects. And I think he's right.
All right. Also, the week prior, the city council came up with some changes for developers.
Yeah, the city council voted a week before last to ease development for parts of the city located near transit centers. They raised the threshold for environmental review from buildings that have more than 30 units in it to buildings that have more than 200 units in them, which means, of course, we're talking about these big buildings, either very narrow and very, very tall, many stories, or we're talking about buildings that take up an entire city block here that will not have to go through any kind of environmental review, so that neighbors will not be able to weigh in on those. Now, it also eliminates requirements for ground floor retail in these buildings. But at the same time, it also eases parking stall requirements for the new buildings, too. So they're saying if you're fairly close to a transportation hub, no matter how far out you are, we're not going to require these buildings to go through any environmental review. We're not going to require parking. We're also not going to require there be any retail there. So in other words, let's take a bunch of people and strand them in the middle of nowhere. And I just have to say, Richard Conlon, who proposed these changes, I would like to see him hauling 6 bags of groceries on the bus or on the light rail. And I've seen people do it, and it is not fun for them, and it is not fun for me or anyone else riding.
Richard has help that will do that for him.
That's my guess, yes.
All right, anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, on to national and Harry Reid.
Yeah, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada, was in the news this week. He was saying he had talked to a Bain Company employee, the old firm of Mitt Romney, and that according to that person, the reason that Romney has been withholding his tax returns for this time was that for 10 of the years in which he's withholding those tax returns, he paid 10 consecutive years, he paid no taxes at all. Now, this is kind of fascinating in that this came out on Tuesday, and the Romney campaign has yet to substantively respond to it, which is really quite revealing, because, you know, assuming that there's anything to this, it's kind of a brilliant political move on Reid's part, because if Romney actually does have nothing to hide, then all he has to do is produce those tax returns to make the most powerful Democrat in Congress and one of the most powerful Democrats in D.C. Look like an idiot and a cheap political hack and all those other things. But he has not done that, which suggests that there's either something in those tax returns that verifies what Reid is saying, or that there's something even worse. That's been a very interesting exchange, and it's an issue that continues to hurt Romney week after week after week, because, you know, there aren't that many people other than dedicated partisans in the country at this point who don't think that Romney is hiding something, and that something must be pretty bad if he's continued to be so stubborn about it.
Yeah, my guess is it's not just that he's paid no tax, it's probably the way in which he's avoided paying tax that's the bad news here.
Yeah, and also remember that the IRS did a widespread tax amnesty in 2009.
Yes.
And who knows, he may have been part of that.
All right. The Senate this week blocking blocking some moves.
Well, specifically Republicans in the Senate, and they've been doing this, of course, ever since the Black Kenyan Socialist became president. But a couple of things that were particularly egregious this week: a cybersecurity bill, and now remember, the Republicans are the party that are always, you know, first and foremost for national security, especially when it's lining their cronies' pockets. But in this case, it was blocked by Senate Republicans, even though the bill was a compromise that had been endorsed by everybody from the ACLU to the NSA and former Bush administration officials. So it was pretty sweeping, described as pretty necessary. Of course, you know, cybersecurity is the sort of thing where you really have to update the laws and update the programs every year or two because the technology is advancing so quickly. And the vulnerabilities are exposed so quickly. Instead, you had the Senate Republicans offering 70 different amendments to it. For example, amendments that would have banned all abortions past the 20th week in the District of Columbia.
How does that relate to cybersecurity?
With no exceptions for the life or health of the mother or victims of rape or incest. Another amendment would have simply repealed Obamacare. I mean, these are things that, as Maria says, are completely not germane, but they're also things that the Republicans knew perfectly well Democrats would not vote for. So basically, they were a big honking waste of time, and then the Republicans got all huffy when the Democrats said, okay, no more amendments. This is ridiculous. So these are the kind of games that are being played with national security by the Republicans in order to try and keep the Obama administration from claiming that it got any legislation passed. Similarly, there was a judge up for confirmation this week, and the 10th district of the federal circuit judges, this guy from Oklahoma named Robert Bacharach, supported by the extremely conservative senators from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn and Jim Inhofe, senators from Big Oil and Big Oil, respectively. Mm-hmm. They wound up joining in the filibuster, as did a number of other Republicans who had originally publicly expressed support for Bacharach, because, again, it was Obama. So according to the New York Times in covering this story, there are currently now 76 vacant federal judgeships, 32 of them regarded as emergencies because the cases are overwhelming the existing judges in those circuits, and 15 of those nominees are consensus nominees from both parties that are pending but cannot get action in the Senate. So this again underscores just how dysfunctional Congress has been, and that dysfunction is flowing directly from one party.
Yes.
All right. The National Democratic Party has something new to its platform.
Yeah. For the first time in its history, the National Democrats are including marriage equality in their platform, which is yet another milestone in our steady march toward. Of course, we have a referendum coming up in November as well that could make Washington State the seventh state to make gay marriage or same-sex marriage legal. Dwight Pelz, however, if you may remember from a couple of months ago, struck marriage equality from the Washington, or vetoed marriage equality from being added to the Washington State Democratic Party's platform because he, quote, didn't want to embarrass President Obama. Now, that came about a week before Obama announced that he had evolved on the event, so on the issue. So one wonders if Pelz has come around on this or if he just hasn't, you know, been bothered yet.
Wow.
Oh, and one that I forgot to mention that came out this week, also a poll from Pew Research, that Mitt Romney is the most unpopular presidential candidate going back to at least 1988, with only 18% favorable rating among undecided. So, again, you know, stories like the refusal to release tax returns or the virtually nonstop gaffes that he kept spewing in his recent foreign trip probably have a lot to do with that.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
So, yes, on Wednesday, a rogue algorithm set off wild trading in the first 2 hours of the day in all of the stock exchanges in the U.S.
Is that like a rogue wave?
Yes, it's a little bit like a rogue wave. It doesn't sweep you to your death, but it can come through and sweep your savings off. It also allows the media and Wall Street to avoid saying that a company and its employees and the company management just messed up by introducing an untested computer program into the trading system. It makes it easy to blame it all on a computer malfunction. Well, what really happened is a company called Knight Capital Group, which is a high-frequency trader, and Knight Capital in itself is responsible for about 11% of all the trades in the market so far this year. So they're a big, big trader.
Garbage in, garbage out, is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, yeah. They bought and sold millions of shares, this program that they released on Wednesday, bought and sold millions of shares of more than 100 companies, causing very, very dramatic price spikes and then equally dramatic price valleys. So it's very similar to what happened during the flash crash of 2010. Now, since then, the SEC had put into place some things that were supposed to avoid this from happening. They put in circuit breakers that are supposed to halt trading if prices swing too much. But those circuit breakers don't kick in until after the first 15 minutes of trading. And these computer programs can buy and sell thousands and thousands of shares in 1 second. So, you know, 15 minutes, as Job said, is eternity. You can literally buy and sell millions, if not tens of millions of shares in those 15 minutes before the circuit breakers kick in. And that's what happened. Now, of course, Knight Capital is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy at this point because of this gaffe. But it also highlights that the SEC, which is supposed to be overseeing and regulating this sort of thing, isn't keeping up with the technology and isn't instituting some things that I think are necessary in order to make the markets more stable. One of those things that they need to do is they need to find some way to slow down trading. High-frequency traders really only exist to make profit off of the penny swings in the prices of stock during the day. Most of them enter the market in the morning. They own no shares in the morning. They throw a whole bunch of money in, buy up a lot of shares of companies, buy and sell and buy and sell and buy and sell throughout the day, and they end the day owning no shares. They just take their cash right out of the market. High-frequency traders really don't provide anything, even though high-frequency trading accounts for about half of all the trading that goes on in the markets during the day in the U.S., they really don't provide much benefit to the markets other than liquidity or convenience. It's nice to know if you have a stock that if you want to sell it today, there's going to be somebody out there who will buy it. On the other hand, it's not so nice to know that your stock that was valued at $50 yesterday just in the last 5 seconds became valued at $5 because of high-frequency traders like Knight Capital.
It also tells you that if half the trading in the United States is being done by these programs that are predicated by and wouldn't be doing it if they weren't extracting money out of the market, the casual investors, you know, people who have their retirement savings that they like to go and play on the stock market, have the odds stacked against them.
Yes,
they
do.
At the end of the day, they are much more likely to lose the money than gain money.
It is a bit of a Ponzi scheme for people who want to trade, buy and sell individual stocks if you're an individual investor. It doesn't have to be that way. If they slowed down trading, they found some way to reintroduce the human element that used to be in the market, things would probably stabilize quite a bit. And, you know, it isn't all that hard to reintroduce a human element either. For example, Ticketmaster does it. When you buy tickets online, you have to enter in a code in order to prove that you're not just a computer program that's buying up huge blocks of tickets. There are ways to do it, and the SEC has not instituted those.
It's actually very difficult to reintroduce those things because it would mean going against the interests of very powerful people.
Well, of a few high-frequency traders, yeah.
Yes.
But I think the bulk
technically, it's not hard.
Yeah, but I think the bulk of people, even the big traders who are not high-frequency traders but trade on behalf of clients, I think they would support something like that.
So real quickly, so these high-frequency traders, they essentially are writing their own software, having it written for them, and then they're just like launching.
There's no
this.
Testing. Yeah, there's no testing. The Knight Capital did not test their program. Ahead
maybe
of time.
They did. Maybe that was their live test. You know,
that
their
was their
test.
Yes. Like I'm saying, there's no oversight at all of what these guys introduce.
All right. Okay. Other
Sleep well.
Yeah.
There goes
yeah.
The savings.
This week, Edward DeMarco, you probably don't know who he is, but he is the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. That's the agency that was set up to oversee Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac currently have about, they have financed about half of all the mortgages in the United States. Now, the Obama administration has asked DeMarco to allow Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to offer debt forgiveness to borrowers the same way that the Obama administration has encouraged private banks to do that.
Now, and bear in mind that the DeMarco is not an Obama administration appointee.
I'm getting to that in
okay,
just a sec.
Sure.
So the idea behind allowing Fannie and Freddie to offer debt forgiveness is it would help keep people in their homes. It would help with consumer spending because people would have, you know, housing security, and it would save taxpayers about $1 billion because the aid to recipients means that they would continue to pay on their mortgages instead of going into default. Now, DeMarco, who was an appointee of the Bush administration, he has refused to do this, even though the Obama administration has offered additional financial incentives to Fannie and Freddie if they offer debt forgiveness. That means that taxpayers, with the additional incentives offered to Fannie and Freddie, taxpayers could save a total of $3.6 to $4 billion. So you have to ask, why isn't DeMarco going ahead and doing what private banks are doing? Well, he says it's ideological, really, but he says that he thinks it would be a net loss to taxpayers, even though his own agency agrees with the Obama administration that taxpayers would gain by it. But he thinks it would encourage more homeowners to stop paying their mortgages so that they could thereby qualify for debt relief. Now, I have to tell you that private banks would very strongly disagree with that. That's the reason why private banks are actually offering debt forgiveness. If they thought that it would encourage more people to default, then they wouldn't be doing it. Defaulting or non-payment can absolutely ruin your credit, and most people don't do it unless they absolutely have to. And we know that. But DeMarco apparently doesn't, and he's allowing that argument to be the smokescreen behind which he's hiding his ideological prejudice against the Obama administration.
And the reason I mentioned that he's a Bush administration appointee is the Obama administration has actually been trying to replace him for the last 3 years, but once again, they can't get a nomination through Senate Republicans.
Yeah, that is absolutely right.
All right. Other economic news?
Yeah, the Tax Policy Center released a study this week of the Romney tax plan. Well, actually, there really is no Romney tax plan. There's just a few talking points and little proposals that he's tossed out. And that's actually one of the big points that they make in their report, that because Romney doesn't have a comprehensive tax plan, all they could really do is analyze the various sound bites that he has had. Where he said, well, this is what I'd like to do, this is this other thing I'd like to do, et cetera. And so they tried to put it all together and make it make sense, and they had a difficult time with that.
And bear in mind, the Tax Policy Center is a completely nonpartisan.
Yeah. So the best that they could do, the best conclusion they could come up with is that it would provide big cuts to the richest 5% of Americans. They would get a really sweet deal. It would also reduce government revenue by $360 billion in 2015. And that increased burden to make up that $360 billion would fall on the middle and lower class Americans, literally anyone who makes less than $200,000. It would definitely mean some kind of tax increase on the 95%. So they went around, they looked at what would that mean? Well, we'd close this loophole, we'd close that loophole, you'd lose the mortgage interest deduction, lose all kinds of different things that would impact mostly lower and middle income Americans in order to make up for the huge tax break he wants to give to rich Americans. Now, they didn't look at cuts to government spending because, of course, Mitt Romney doesn't have a plan for that either.
Yeah, and bear in mind that the Tax Policy Center went through, and wherever possible, they tried to give the best possible break and interpretation to the Republicans so that, for example, they used the Romney campaign's assumptions about how cutting taxes for the rich would spur economic growth, even though most
economists
don't agree with
highly
that.
Highly questionable.
They made the assumption that Mitt Romney would go after tax breaks and loopholes for the wealthy first, which doesn't seem consistent with his track record. Nonetheless, they said just by the nature of the math, the plan would force slashing tax breaks for mortgage interest, for employee-provided health care, or employer-provided health care, for education, for medical expenses, state and local taxes, and child care. All of those benefits that are primarily impact the middle class. And their bottom line conclusion is that what Romney is proposing, quote, is not mathematically possible. So draw your own conclusion from that.
Yeah, which is probably why he doesn't have a real tax quote-unquote plan out there.
And doesn't want to say anything other than, you know, generic talking points.
He doesn't want to try to defend it. So international?
Yeah, Greenland.
Yeah. Greenland in July, in 4 days in July, went through record surface melting of its ice sheet. Usually in July, about 25% to 40%, somewhere in there, of the top surface of the Greenland ice sheet has melted. Well, from July 8th through July 12th, just over 4 days, the surface melt went from 40% to 97% of the ice sheet, which is something that scientists have never seen before. It's
even way out of proportion to anything scientists have seen before.
Yeah. Now, after about July 14th, it started to refreeze, but they were pretty alarmed seeing that that it could happen so quickly over the course of just 4 days to see almost the entire surface of the ice sheet melt. And they really didn't have a good explanation for why it happened now and why it happened so abruptly. They said that a series of high pressure warm ridges of weather had moved across Greenland, but they've seen that before, and so they were pretty surprised at this.
I think it's sunspots.
Yep, I think it's global warming.
Right. No, that's a conspiracy of liberal scientists. I'm sorry.
Can you cover Syria?
Syria, yes. Week before last, the U.S. government finally openly acknowledged that the Obama administration is attempting to overthrow the Syrian government, that we are indeed increasing aid to the rebels. The U.S. CIA officers and U.S. intelligence are coordinating delivery of weapons to the rebels. The Obama administration is also openly talking with Israel about how to destroy Syrian weapons facilities. Also, we are in talks with exile groups to help set up a new provisional government for Syria. And the U.S. admitted that the CIA is operating in southern Turkey, which means, of course, they're probably also operating in Syria as well.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is playing with fire because the Syrian rebels, number one, have been responsible for their own atrocities, and number two, they are also vastly outarmed by the Syrian government, and so the chances that civilians are going to get caught in the crossfire are very, very high.
Yes, and the what is left of the peaceful opposition in Syria has complained that by arming the Syrian rebels, it is basically given a blank check to fundamentalist groups to try to take over the Syrian opposition, because those folks are the most militant among the Syrian opposition.
Yeah, and there are half a dozen countries with vested interests in all this, too.
Yes.
Events.
Several of them. Starting in about 45 seconds, Ground Zero will kick off its weekend of activities around the anniversary of Hiroshima Day. All day, today and tomorrow, and then Monday morning. Today, Dorley Rainey,
outspoken
octogenarian, is that correct? Yeah. Yes. Occupy activist, and she's been an activist in many, many things over the year. She'll be speaking over there at 1:30 today. Jim and Shelley Douglas, the original founders of Ground Zero and enormously influential in the late 70s and 1980s resistance to the Trident base, are in town for Hiroshima Day this year. They'll be talking at 6 o'clock tonight, and then Cindy Sheehan talking at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, and Direct Action 7 o'clock Monday morning. There's a full schedule and all the details at www.gzcenter.org, and it is at right adjacent to the nuclear subbase at Bangor at 16159 Clear Creek Road in Polesbo. Monday is the actual anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, and as usual this year, Hiroshima to Hope will be having a lantern floating in commemoration on Green Lake. The program starts at 6 o'clock. It goes through 9:30 when we have sunset and the actual lantern floating, which is beautiful. For anybody who's never seen it, I recommend you go out there. It's very family-friendly. It's on Green Lake on the west shore, south of the bathhouse in the Green Lake neighborhood. And then also August 7th, Tuesday, is the deadline day for your primary ballots for the primary election. So send those ballots in by then. Absolutely. And we have also the recommendations for those ballots at eatthestate.org.
Talk. And as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And again, where do people find Eat the State?
Eatthestate.org. And the primary and ballot recommendations are there too.
Yes. And you can find some of my back articles at mariatomchick.com.